The Best of Isaac Asimov by Isaac Asimov. Copyright 1973 by Isaac Asimov. This recording of the reading of The Best of Isaac Asimov was published by arrangement with Doubleday and Company, Incorporated, and was produced in 1979 by Books on Tape, Incorporated, which holds the copyright thereto. Neither this recording nor any part thereof may be reproduced or used for any purpose without prior written authority from Books on Tape, Incorporated. Introduction. I must admit the title of this book gives me pause. Who says the enclosed stories are my best? Do I? Does the editor? Or some critic? Some reader? A general vote among the entire population of the world? And whoever says it, can it be so? Can the word best mean anything at all, except to some particular person in some particular mood? Perhaps not. So if we allow the word to stand as an absolute, you, or perhaps you, may be appalled at omissions or inclusions, or never having read me before, may even be impelled to cry out, "Good heavens, are those his best?" So I'll be honest with all of you. What is included here in this book are a dozen stories chosen in such a way as to span a third of a century of writing, with two early samples, two late samples, and eight from the gold decade, for me, of the 50s. Those presented are as nearly representative as is consistent with the careful selection of good stories, i.e., those the editor and I like, and as nearly the best of my stories as is consistent with making them representative. I suppose we ought really call the book The Pretty Good and Pretty Representative Stories of Isaac Asimov, but who would then buy it? So best it is. As to the individual stories, 1. Marooned Off Vesta was the very first story I ever published, so its inclusion is virtually a necessity. It wasn't the first I ever wrote with the hope of publication. Actually, it was the third. The first was never sold and no longer exists. The second was sold a couple of years after it was written, but is not very good. Far be it from me to crave indulgence, but I think it is important to understand that at the time I wrote and sold the story, in 1938, I was 18 years old and had spent all the years I could remember in a city slum. My visions of strong adventurers bravely facing danger in distant vastnesses was just that, visionary. 2. Nightfall, written 2.5 years later, was the 32nd story I had written. What else did I have to do in those days except work in my father's candy store and study for my college degrees? And perhaps the 14th story published. Yet within less than 3 years of the start of my career, it turned out that I had written The Best of Asimov. At least, Nightfall has been frequently reprinted, is commonly referred to as a classic, and when some magazine or fan organization conducts a vote on short stories, it frequently ends up on the top of the list, not only of my stories, but of anybody's. One of its advantages is that it has a unique plot. There was nothing resembling it ever published before, as far as I know. And, of course, it is now so well known that nothing like it can be published again. It's nice to have one story like that, anyway. Yet I was only 21 when I wrote it, and was still feeling my way. It isn't my favorite. Later on, I'll tell you what my favorite is, and you can then judge for yourself. 3. Sea Shoot comes after a 10-year hiatus, as far as the stories included in this book are concerned. I hadn't quit writing, of course, don't think that. To be sure, I had slowed down a bit, what with the war and the time-consuming effort toward the doctorate. But the real reason for the gap is that I spent most of the 40s writing the stories collected in my books I, Robot and the Foundation Trilogy. It seemed inadvisable to amputate portions of either for this collection. Sea Shoot comes near the beginning of my mature period, or whatever you want to call it. I had my PhD. I was an assistant professor of biochemistry at Boston University School of Medicine. I had finished my first 3 books, and I was full of self-confidence. What's more, I had broken away from the exclusive dependence on astounding science fiction. New magazines had arisen to challenge its leadership, notably Galaxy, and also Fantasy and Science Fiction. Sea Shoot appeared in Galaxy. So did the next 2 stories in the collection. 4. The Martian Way represents my reaction to the McCarthy era, a time in the early 50s when Americans seemed to abandon their own history and become, in some cases, witch hunters, in some cases, victims, in most cases, cowards. Brave men remained, fortunately, which is why we pulled out of it. The Martian Way, written and published at the height of the McCarthy era, was my own personal statement of position. I felt very brave at the time and was disappointed that no one ever as much as frowned at me in consequence. I must have been too subtle, or too unimportant. A second point about the story is that I managed to foresee something accurately. Science fiction writers are often assumed to be keen-eyed peers into the future, who see things others don't. Actually, few writers have much of a record in this respect, and mine at best can only be said to attain the abysmally low average. Just the same, in The Martian Way, I described the euphoric effects of the spacewalk, 15 years before anyone had spacewalked. And then, when they did, euphoria is apparently what they experienced. 5. The Deep is the sleeper of the collection. Every once in a while, I wrote a story which, though good in my opinion, and I don't like all my stories, seems to stir up no reaction. This is one of them. Perhaps it's because I deliberately chose to describe a society in which mother love was a crime, and the world wasn't ready for that. 6. The Fun They Had is probably the biggest surprise of my literary career. A personal friend asked me to write a little science fiction story for a syndicated boys and girls newspaper page he edited, and I agreed for friendship's sake. I expected it would appear in a few newspapers for one day, and would then disappear forever. However, fantasy and science fiction picked it up, and to my surprise, the reprint requests began to come in. It has been reprinted at least 30 times, and there has been no time in perhaps 15 years, including right now, when new reprints haven't been pending. Why? I don't know why. If I had the critic's mentality, which I emphatically don't, I would sit down and try to analyze my stories, work out the factors that make some more successful than others, cultivate those factors, and simply explode with excellence. But the devil with that. I won't buy success at the price of self-consciousness. I don't have the temperament for it. I'll write as I please and let the critics do the analyzing. Yesterday, someone said to me that a critic was like a eunuch in a harem. He could observe, study, and analyze, but he couldn't do it himself. 7. The last question is my personal favorite, the one story I made sure would not be omitted from this collection. Why is it my favorite? For one thing, I got the idea all at once and didn't have to fiddle with it, and I wrote it in white heat and scarcely had to change a word. This sort of thing endears any story to any writer. Then, too, it has had the strangest effect on my readers. Frequently, someone writes to ask me if I can give them the name of a story, which they think I may have written, and I tell them where to find it. They don't remember the title, but when they describe the story, it is invariably the last question. This has reached the point where I recently received a long-distance phone call from a desperate man who began, "Dr. Asimov, there's a story I think you wrote whose title I can't remember," at which point I interrupted to tell him it was the last question. And when I described the plot, it proved to be indeed the story he was after. I left him convinced I could read minds at a distance of 1,000 miles. No other story I have written has anything like this effect on my readers, producing at once an unshakable memory of the plot and an unshakable forgettery of the title and even author. I think it may be that the story fills them so frighteningly full that they can retain none of the side issues. 8. The Dead Past was written after I had been teaching for 7 years. I was as saturated as could be with the world of scientific research. Naturally, anyone who writes is going to reveal the world in which he is immersed, whether he wants to or desperately wants not to. I've never tried to avoid letting my personal background creep into my stories, but I must admit it has rarely crept in quite as thickly as it did in this one. As an example of how my stories work out, consider this. I had my protagonist interested in Carthage because I myself am a great admirer of Hannibal and have never quite gotten over the Battle of Zama. I introduced Carthage, idly, without any intention of weaving it into the plot, but it got woven in just the same. That happens to me over and over. Some writers work out the stories in meticulous detail before starting and stick to the outline. P.G. Woodhouse does it, I understand, and I worship his books. But just the same, I don't. I work out my ending, decide on a beginning, and then proceed, letting everything in between work itself out as I come to it. 9. The Dying Knight is an example of a mystery as well as a science fiction story. I have been a mystery reader as long as I have been a science fiction reader, and on the whole, I think I enjoy mysteries more. I'm not sure why that is. Perhaps it was that after I became an established science fiction writer, I was no longer able to relax with science fiction stories. I read every story keenly aware that it might be worse than mine, in which case I had no patience with it, or that it might be better, in which case I felt miserable. Mysteries, especially the intellectual puzzle variety, ah, good old Hercule Poirot, offered me no such stumbling blocks. Sooner or later, then, I was bound to try my hand at science fiction mysteries, and The Dying Knight is one of these. 10. Anniversary was written to fulfill a request, that I write a story for the March 1959 issue of Amazing Stories as a way of celebrating the 20th anniversary of the March 1939 issue, which had contained my first published story, Marooned Off Vesta. So inevitably, I wrote a story dealing with the characters of Marooned Off Vesta 20 years later. The magazine then ran both stories together, and I was sure someone would send me a letter saying that my writing was better in the first story, but no one did. Perhaps a reader of this book will decide it would be humorous to do so, but if so, please restrain yourself. 11. The billiard ball comes in this collection after an 8-year hiatus and is an example of my late style. That is, if there is such a thing. Some critics say that it is a flaw in my literary nature that I haven't grown, that my late stories have the same style and aura of my early stories. Maybe you'll think so too, and scorn me in consequence. But then I've already told you what some people think of critics. The reason for the hiatus is that in 1958 I quit the academic life to become a full-time writer. I at once proceeded to write everything under the sun, straight science, straight mystery, children's books, histories, literary annotations, etymology, humor, etc., etc., except science fiction. I never entirely abandoned it, of course. Witness the billiard ball. 12. Mirror Image is a particularly recent science fiction short story I've written for the magazines, and unlike the first 11 stories, has not yet had time to be reprinted. One of the reasons for writing it was to appease those readers who were forever asking me for sequels, for one more book involving characters who have appeared in previous books. One of the most frequent requests was that I write a third novel to succeed The Caves of Steel and The Naked Sun, both of which dealt with the adventures of the detective, Elijah Bailey, and his robot assistant, R. Daniil Olivaw. Unable to find the time to do so, I wrote a short story about them, Mirror Image. Alas, all I got as a result were a spate of letters saying, "Thanks, but we mean a novel." Anyway, there you are. Turn the page and you can begin a representative, and possibly a more or less best, 115,000 words or so, out of the roughly 2 million words of science fiction I have written so far. I hope it amuses you. And if it doesn't, remember that I have also written about 7,500,000 words of non-science fiction, and you are at least spared any of that. Isaac Asimov. The Best of Isaac Asimov.